Penguin Random House Audio presents Sonic Life, a memoir. This is the author, Thurston Moore. For the Daydream Nation. Book 1. Chapter 1. Epiphany. Jean bounded into our small South Miami, Florida house the summer of 1963, a look on his face as if he had located a gift of gold dropped from a psychedelic UFO. In his hand he clutched an article of Sonic Subterfuge, a 7-inch black vinyl single deliriously titled Louie Louie by a group called The Kingsmen. Their name suggested royal knaves, subjects of a British invasion-informed notion of aristocracy, and not the four-hip sneering roustabouts from the Pacific Northwest that they were. From that moment onward, my brother's universe and mine would become all flash lightning, Louie Louie ringing out repeatedly, a seductive noise machine from on high, the singer wailing out of control and completely cool, steering us toward an undeniable future. Okay, let's give it to him right now. I was 5 years old to Gene's 10, my response to the record driven as much by the sound as by my older brother's excitement. He reverently spun the single, an artifact from pre-teen heaven that he had somehow stumbled onto. The only other music heard in our house had been our father's classical records, and more profoundly the sounds emanating from his hours-long performances at the piano, an instrument that commanded most of the real estate in our modest living room. He worked deliberately through a repertoire of Beethoven, Bach, Brahms, Mendelssohn, and other heavies. Classical music ruled our airwaves, at least until Louie Louie came breaking and entering in. With that disc in constant revolution, the energy of our existence would change, a new current of electricity introduced. It was as though it had taken the sound world of our day, our kitchen appliances, our television, and recast it into song, using only guitars, organ, and drums. The lead singer's voice had the air of a boy smoking a cigarette with one hand while banging a tambourine in the other, an insolent distance to his delivery, a vision of being at once boss and bored. The flip side of the record was Haunted Castle, an instrumental with a simplistic chord figure and a suitably mysterious vibe. The fun danger of Louie Louie was offset by the cool otherness of Haunted Castle. Everything about these subversive vibrations suggested to me a new world. They were changing not only my here and now, but my vision of what the future might hold for me. I decided to someday, somehow, be in a band like the Kingsmen. The first order of business would be my hair. From flipping through the pages of 16 Magazine, the Bible of 1960s pop rock teen idol worship, I could see how the cool cats in bands like the Kingsmen all had bangs grazing their eyebrows, the back of their hair hanging slightly below their collars. To grown-ups, my little boy crew cut was cute. But after my blinding introduction to rock and roll by way of Louie Louie, I knew it would no longer do. Forget cute. After a bit of pleading, I was given permission by my parents to let my hair grow out. Each day I would check its progress, wetting the minuscule strands of my potential fringe so that it might fall onto my forehead, yearning to flick it casually to the side. A few of my classmates at the Epiphany Catholic School took me to task for my preening and faux flicking. You don't have long hair, stop pretending. But I needed the practice. My father's piano had always been our family's great and sacred object. It cost as much as a car, and we were living on a schoolteacher's wages. But it was a necessary extravagance, not just an outlet for my father, but a collective beacon of high art, a reflection, I thought, of our commitment to sound and composition. But it wasn't for me. What I really wanted was a guitar, preferably electric, or at least a transistor radio, anything that could bring more Louie Louie into the world. Chapter 2. Refrigerator Heaven. In 1947, my father, George Moore, age 22, met Eleanor Nan, 2 years younger, in music class at the University of Miami, the two falling forever in love. Just a few years prior, each of their lives had been subsumed by war. My mother working as a soldier's aide at the Biltmore Hotel, then outfitted as a hospital in nearby Coral Gables. My father enlisted as a military bandleader, though with the good fortune not to be stationed overseas. He had learned music theory and piano from his mother, a society pianist. Both my parents' families had been living in Coral Gables, a charmed and enchanted enclave tucked just below the city of Miami, a paradise of huge banyan trees presiding over narrow streets, their trunks and branches knotty and adorned with thick hanging vines. Green grass lawns were nurtured by tropical rains, which would rage for an hour, then break for high, humid sunshine. Iguanas, lizards, grass snakes, parrots, and peacocks freely roamed. The tolling bells of the Church of the Little Flower, where my parents would marry after 3 years of dreamtime romance, filled the air, resounding off the walls of homes, some made of old Spanish stucco, others built from coral rock. My brother Jean arrived in 1953, followed 2 years later by my sister Susan. I was conceived in the autumn of 1957 in Mount Dora, Florida, in a tiny house outside of the grade school where my father had found a teaching job. For my birth, my mother traveled back to Coral Gables. A family physician delivered me on Friday, July 25, 1958, at 7:37 in the evening. I was named after Thurston Doc Adams, my father's stepfather, a larger-than-life character who had become the vivacious patriarch of our extended family. Doc himself claimed to have been named out of his parents' admiration for Thurston the Great Magician and his self-proclaimed Wonder Show of the Universe, which had traveled the Southeast early in the century. At the end of the 1950s, our family of five would relocate, first to McKenzie, Tennessee, where my father had found a new job teaching at a local college, then back down to Florida a few years later, setting up house in South Miami, before packing up all our belongings once again and heading north in 1967 to Bethel, Connecticut. My father had found a more desirable academic position at Western Connecticut State College in nearby Danbury. He was to teach art appreciation, philosophy, humanities, and phenomenology. I was 10 years old. Leaving behind the perennial sunshine of southern Florida, I would, for the first time, experience true seasons, dying leaves, snow, and ice. Before heading north, I had been gifted an inexpensive acoustic guitar. The idea was that if I could figure out how to play the thing, I might possibly advance to an electric. The acoustic had nylon strings, not very rock, but they could still make a kind of thrum. I went to the town hall in Bethel to take lessons with a bunch of other aspiring preteen guitarists. I had stuck an STP decal on the guitar in hopes of imbuing it with a bit of cool, STP being the iconic race car motor oil brand denoting speed, or so it seemed to me. The serious guitarists in the class looked down their noses at my STP machine, particularly as I'd brought it in without a case, naked and battered. The teacher attempted to show us how to play Kumbaya. I quickly realized that I would not be returning. As the 70s got underway, Gene acquired an electric Fender Stratocaster, which he played obsessively. He was 18 to my 13. I managed to glean a bit of fretboard familiarity from simply observing him, watching him play day and night, chordings, fingerings, strumming techniques. Gene and his hippie friends often sat around our house, endlessly riffing on their axes, spinning records, smoking cigs, laughing, talking about bands and concerts. They each had one group that was all their own, taking it upon themselves to collect every record, becoming the designated aficionado. One guy would be all into the
sample complete. Ready to continue?